This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
COVID rates in Europe on the rise. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is warning everybody has to do their part.
It is no answer to say that we could let the virus take hold among the young and fit while shielding the elderly and vulnerable.
Also today, China is investing in infrastructure across the globe to mixed reviews. People in Greenland are conflicted about getting Chinese help.
Should we be afraid? We don't know. I mean, what this country needs is... are people willing to invest?
I'm Marco Werman, and we'll find out about the man on track to be the first millennial saint.
Some of my students were thrilled by the fact that Carlo's body was displayed wearing sweatpants and Nike shoes.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us this Monday. According to the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, you had today off to recognize Christopher Columbus. According to a lot of others, today's holiday is Indigenous Peoples Day, a chance to rethink Columbus's legacy of violence toward the people who already lived in the so-called New World. In parts of Latin America, it's also a holiday and is known by different names. In Chile, it's called the Day of the Encounter of Two Worlds. In Peru, the Day of Indigenous Peoples. And in Mexico, it's called Día de la Raza, loosely translated to Day of Racial Remembrance. Mexico City has one statue of Christopher Columbus. It's long been mired in controversy. This weekend, the mayor there ordered it removed. On Saturday, overnight, a work crew quietly took the statue down. They wrapped it in plastic and hauled it away. The World's Jorge Valencia is on the line from Mexico City. Said the statue was taken down at night, spirited away. Jorge, it sounded kind of sudden. Why exactly did Mexico City remove the statue?
The official reason, according to the mayor of Mexico City, Mayor Claudia Sheinbaum, is that the statue was taken away for renovations. She spoke about it on Saturday, and if she sounds a little bit muffled, it's because she was out in public and she was wearing a face mask.
La decisión de quitar la estatua tiene que ver con un tema de...
So the mayor says that they had been planning to do renovations on the statue for a long time. It's important to highlight what you just pointed out, that it was done overnight without any type of fanfare. I mean, it was done very quietly. And also that there's a little bit of context surrounding the statue, which is that there had been groups that had been asking, demanding the city to take down the statue for years now. They had been vandalizing the statue. And some groups had said that they were going today on El Día de la Raza, they were going to take down the statue. So all of this is happening at the same time, and the mayor just says, look, it's just for renovation purposes, we took it away.
So now the statue's gone. It's going to get renovated. Does that mean that in Mexico, I mean, similar to here in the U.S., there's not a real consensus over removing a statue of Christopher Columbus?
No, there is not a consensus. It's similar to the way that it is in the U.S. in that some people find it offensive that statues of colonizers are there. They see it as a form of celebrating, literally elevating colonizers. And then there are people who believe that it is part of the country's history, that the statues were put there for a reason, that they should remain there. This is the sentiment in Mexico and in many countries in Latin America. The biggest difference is that in Mexico, at the very least, there aren't armed groups protecting these statues. But there is still, I mean, some controversy over it. There is disagreement. I spoke about this with Federico Navarrete. He's a historian here in Mexico City. And he says he believes that a majority of Mexicans believe that this statue shouldn't be up at all.
I think it speaks very clearly to the widespread feeling of most of Mexico's population, which is some sort of rejection of this kind of colonialism and the consequences it has brought upon indigenous history, upon Mexican history in general, and also particularly on the indigenous people of Mexico.
The president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has made a point of including indigenous rights in his public rhetoric. He even asked Spain and the Vatican to apologize for colonizing what is now Mexico. How has that worked out, Jorge? And how do indigenous people in Mexico see moves like that?
Yeah, well, this was a very interesting gesture when President Andrés Manuel López Obrador sent a letter to the King of Spain and to the Pope saying that they should apologize to the people of Mexico. Some people thought that it was a good idea. And just so you know how at least that part of it ended was that there's been no apology. But it did spur debate here in Mexico. And there isn't a consensus about whether or not that's even necessary or that even would be right. And Mexico is a land of many indigenous communities. And so there are many different opinions on it. And in fact, one is actually that there shouldn't be an apology from Spain, there shouldn't be an apology from the Vatican, but there should be an apology from the Mexican government, because it has been the Mexican government, in their opinion, the primary force that has marginalized primarily indigenous communities, also Afro-Mexican communities, by the way. And so this is a debate that is ongoing, and it wouldn't just end if the King of Spain or the Pope apologized for it.
The World's Jorge Valencia speaking with us from Mexico City. Thanks very much, Jorge.
Thanks, Marco.
Checking in on the pandemic now. Globally, new coronavirus cases are spiking, averaging more than 300,000 a day over the past week. In much of South America, though, the number of new reported cases is falling, and nations are easing lockdown restrictions. It's giving hope to Venezuelan migrants desperate to flee their country's broken economy. Despite the positive health developments, the coronavirus has made the journeys of Venezuelan migrants much more complicated. Manuel Rueda has a story from Pamplona, Colombia.
Daniel Arevalo is dragging his suitcase again. This time, he's leaving Pamplona, a Colombian mountain town, for Cali, a city on the other side of the country. He's hoping to find construction work there and is trying to hitch a ride. Arevalo is far from his home in Venezuela and doesn't plan to return anytime soon.
La situación en Venezuela cada día va más peor.
The situation is getting worse every day, he says. Arevalo joined the millions who've left Venezuela since 2015 to escape hyperinflation, food shortages, and low wages. The minimum wage in Venezuela is currently less than $2 a month. The exodus nearly stopped in April, though, because the places Venezuelans are heading to, Peru, Colombia, and Ecuador, have seen their own economies stall due to the pandemic. Now restrictions are lifting and convincing Venezuelans to leave again. Some officials expect about 200,000 Venezuelans to migrate in the coming months. The poorest Venezuelans walk for long stretches at a time, or take rides on the back of trucks. Arevalo, wearing his flip-flops, still has 500 miles to go before his destination.
Muy caro el pasaje, por la cuestión de que no tenemos papeles, no tenemos permiso y eso.
He says that bus tickets are too expensive, and because he's undocumented in Colombia, some bus drivers charge him more. The pandemic is also making some routes tougher. Colombia has closed its border crossings with Venezuela because of the virus. That's forcing migrants to take dirt trails, often controlled by drug traffickers. Officials have also closed shelters to limit large gatherings. So, with nowhere indoors to sleep, you'll see Venezuelan migrants, including kids, sleeping outside in border towns like Pamplona. Johan Guerra was trying to rest on a gym mat on a sidewalk with his wife and 6-year-old son. It's near freezing at night and is rarely quiet. Cargo trucks are roaring by. The family was waiting for a ride over a mountain. That's taken longer now. Fewer drivers are picking up hitchhikers because they're worried about the virus and contagion. If you have a child with you, it's not easy to walk all the way, Guerra says. Some people are helping, offering families clothing and food. Marta Duque once ran a shelter for women and children here in Pamplona until the government shut it down. Now she's cooking free meals for dozens of migrants each day. When we meet, she's preparing a soup in her yard with rice, lentils, and vegetables donated by neighbors.
Me duele mucho ver la población de niños y mujeres tirados en el piso durmiendo a la intemperie con el frío.
Duque says it hurts to see families in the cold. She's also angry that officials closed her shelter but are not offering migrants a plan B.
No fue la solución, debió haberse tenido un plan B.
The Colombian government says it's trying to stop the virus from spreading and that it's already granted temporary residence to more than 500,000 Venezuelans. But there's little Colombia can do to stop people from coming. Veronica Gomez was walking along the highway. She talks about the obstacles she's faced since leaving Venezuela last month.
Hemos entrado pagando porque tampoco dejan entrar hacia acá.
She says she had to pay a local gang about $40 to enter Colombia through a dirt trail. She's heading for Lima, Peru, where she's migrated to before. But this time, she's not alone. Her partner and teenage son have joined her. They expect the journey end to end, to take at least a month.
Trabajar y poder ayudar a mi familia que está en Venezuela. Esa es mi meta.
My goal is to work and help my family, Gomez says. I never thought that I'd have to come so far to do that. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Pamplona, Colombia.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson today announced new coronavirus restrictions for cities in England. The UK is one of multiple European nations now imposing new local restrictions as infection rates continue to climb. In France, bars have been shut in six cities, including Paris. In Spain, the government has imposed a state of emergency in Madrid. Orla Barry is the World's Europe correspondent and joins me from London. So let's take a look ahead at how Europe is faring as it heads into the pandemic's fall and winter timeline. Starting where you are in the UK, because infection rates for COVID-19 in Britain have surpassed most of the European neighbors there. What's in store for the UK in the coming months, Orla?
Yeah, long winter by the sounds of things, Marco. Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he laid out some of the measures this afternoon, and he began by reminding people just how bad things have gotten, essentially, over the last few weeks. There are more people in hospital now with COVID than when the UK went into lockdown in March, so that alone tells you where we're at. But the Prime Minister has said he won't be introducing a national lockdown like we had back in the spring. What he did say, though, is that for those people who think that nature should take its course and we'd be done with the restrictions, that this simply doesn't work. This isn't the route to take.
If we were to follow that course, Mr. Speaker, and let the virus rip, then the bleak mathematics dictate that we would suffer not only an intolerable death toll from COVID, we would put such a huge strain on our NHS that our doctors and nurses would be simply unable to devote themselves to other treatments.
So what he went on to say is that the government is effectively introducing this new three-tier system for across the country, ranging from you're in a medium to high to very high risk area. And essentially in a very high zone, bars, restaurants, gyms, etc. will all close, but schools and universities will remain open. And today the bad news was for Liverpool. They said that the city of Liverpool in 2 days' time will have to close down.
Right. So that's one city in the UK, Liverpool, that's seeing its bars close. I mentioned earlier in France, pubs across Paris and five other French cities, they're closing too, right?
Yeah. And in fact, they're adding two more cities tomorrow, as far as I know. Toulouse and Montpellier are also joining that list. In Paris, it's bars only that have to close. Restaurants are, in fact, allowed to stay open. So I was talking to a couple of Parisian bar owners this afternoon who said they're doing everything to ensure they can keep serving food so they can essentially keep their bar open until closing time. But that's not the case in Marseille, for example, where everything is shut. Bars and restaurants have been forced to close down.
If we look at Spain, Spain fared pretty badly in the first wave of coronavirus in the spring. And right now it doesn't seem to be doing too much better. What is the problem this time in Spain? Is it just the country is just not retaining the lessons from the first wave?
In a sense, it's hard to say because there was a lot of this analysis in early September that what did Spain do wrong? And now France and the UK and the Czech Republic and other countries have caught up. So let's just maybe all of us take the blame upon ourselves. I don't think any country has been doing anything particularly right. Also, the Spanish government has been blaming young people going out partying during the summertime. There has been the point that in working class neighbourhoods of Madrid that the spread has been particularly high. But again, that's because people are living in very close quarters. So the national government has introduced a state of emergency in Madrid.
So the trend is kind of troubling in Western Europe, Orla. Do you see this continuing in Eastern Europe, countries like the Czech Republic and Hungary? What are they facing?
If you remember early in the year, actually, Eastern Europe fared rather well. You know, countries like the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, their numbers were relatively low. And part of the reason was the Czech Republic, for example, locked down hard and it locked down early. Hungary shut all its borders very fast, as Viktor Orban is wont to do anyway. But now the Czech Republic reported over the weekend the highest rates of any country in Europe. It is the fastest growing daily number of new cases in Europe. And that's really taken them by surprise. So from today, bars and restaurants in the Czech Republic have to close at 8 p.m.
The World's Orla Barry in London with the latest on the troubling spike in cases of COVID-19 across many parts of Europe. Orla, good to speak with you today. Thanks.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Think patron saint of the internet. Maybe Saint Isidore of Seville comes to mind, the saint many associate with computers and the net. You're either thinking Saint Isidore or thousands of cat videos. This weekend, patron saint of the internet took on new meaning for the Catholic Church. The Church beatified an Italian teenager named Carlo Acutis, bringing him one step closer to becoming the first millennial saint. Kathleen Cummings has been following the story. She's the director of the Kushwa Center for the Study of American Catholicism at the University of Notre Dame. Kathleen, what do we know about Carlo Acutis, this first possible millennial saint?
He convinced the people that knew him in his lifetime that he was holy. And he did that through a means that is definitely modern and fitting for someone who is likely to become the first millennial saint. He did it through computers, through social media. Then the people that believed he was holy nominated him for the church's highest honor, which is canonization, and initiated a process through which people at the Vatican evaluated everything that he had written, in this case, all of the emails that he had sent, all of the websites he visited, and determined that indeed he had lived a life of extraordinary virtue.
Was he essentially evangelizing online? And is the Catholic Church kind of looking to the future here, especially in the age of COVID when everything has moved online?
Absolutely. So saints always become popular in particular contexts, and Catholics look for saints who they can relate to in some way. He used the internet to, yes, as you say, evangelize, to publicize miracles, to think about the Eucharist. At a time when we are so worried as a society about the corrosive effects of social media on young people in particular, Carlo's story is a sign that the internet can be used for good purposes as well. And that's a big part of his appeal.
Could a millennial saint also be a way to attract younger people to the church? Is that a message that the church is kind of looking at?
Oh, that's a message that the church definitely wants to send. It's no secret that many young people are leaving the church or are not finding in the church what they need. So I know I can share that some of my students here at Notre Dame were thrilled by the fact that Carlo's body was displayed wearing sweatpants and Nike shoes. He's someone that they can relate to. He's someone that looks familiar to them, someone who grew up with computers. Canonization is one way that the Catholic Church tries to stay relevant. It uses the stories of saints to show that there's all sorts of ways to live a holy life in our contemporary world. Many Catholics will be able to relate to the story of Carlo, and I think he's a good option for the first millennial saint.
I mean, Acutis sounds like a unicorn. Could he have this status for a while and then kind of become part of a larger group of modern saints that speak to other issues in modern life?
The pace of saint-making in the Catholic Church has been increasing. It started with Pope John Paul II, who now himself is a canonized saint, but during his papacy, he canonized more people than all of his predecessors combined. He absolutely loved to canonize people and believed that there should be as many models of holiness in the Catholic Church as possible. Canonization, if you take away the holiness part of it, it's really about marketing. It's really about getting stories circulating. Because of social media, because of ways we've become a more globally connected community, it's easier to get stories out there. So in that sense, it's very easy for people all over the world to hear about this boy from Milan. So yes, I do think we're going to continue to see an uptick in the canonization of contemporary saints, saints who didn't live in places far away and places long ago, but who are really seen as more contemporaries. And certainly based on the speed at which Carlo proceeded through the first stages of the canonization process, I think we can expect that we'll see him move rather quickly to the next one.
Kathleen Cummings with the Kushwa Center for the Study of American Catholicism at the University of Notre Dame. She's also the author of A Saint of Our Own, How the Quest for a Holy Hero Helped Catholics Become American. Kathleen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Another important Catholic was online this week, the Pope.
Buongiorno. Viviamo un momento storico segnato.
The second TED Talk for Pope Francis went live on Saturday. The topic was a familiar theme for the pontiff, the urgency of climate change.
La scienza ci dice ogni giorno con più precisione.
The Pope said, science tells us every day with more precision that urgent action is needed. And I am not dramatizing. This is what science says. We must act now.
Essere indifferente di fronte alle sofferenze dei più poveri.
Pope Francis spoke of the humanitarian impacts of climate change affecting some people more than others and widening existing inequalities.
L'economia stessa non può limitarsi.
For years, the Pope has spoken about the moral imperative of action. At the White House 5 years ago, for example, in front of President Obama and a crowd of thousands.
When it comes to the care of our common home, we are living at a critical moment of history.
The care of our common home, the Pope said there, i.e. our planet. The release of the Pope's TED Talk was part of a larger virtual TED event this weekend. Artists, activists, and world leaders sharing their reflections on the climate crisis, like Prince William in the UK.
Over my grandmother's lifetime, the last 90 years or so, our impact has accelerated so fast that our climate, oceans, air, nature, and all that depends on them are in peril.
And Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission.
Fighting climate change has become the greatest responsibility of our times. And this is why in Europe, we have set our objective to become the first carbon-neutral continent by 2050.
Yvonne Aki-Sawyer also spoke. She's the mayor of Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, which has seen its own share of increasingly erratic weather in recent years, driven in part by climate change.
Our goal? To increase vegetation cover by 50% in Freetown by the end of my term in 2022.
The Sierra Leone part of this virtual TED event also included a musical experience.
Hello, my name is Yemi Alade. I am a musician, an actor, and also a proud Nigerian.
Yemi Alade, one of several artists who joined the global chorus of voices fighting for climate action.
I am part of a community challenging one another to find ways to reduce the amount of carbon emissions globally.
Alade says climate change has affected a lot of things in Nigeria, but so far, not the music.
It's what we do best. It stayed the same, and I want to share that with you right now. So get ready. True love. Let's go.
DJ, play that hop.
Don't forget to my sorrows.
Make them play that hop. Make them play the happy music. Make the people feel alright. Hey, ay 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 ay. Oh na 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 na.
True love for the planet. That's Nigeria's Yemi Alade. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. In several swing states, African and Caribbean immigrants could play a pivotal role. In Florida, this woman from Nigeria is organizing for Biden.
When it comes to Africa, he has always been strong. He's a strong voice, even during apartheid.
But black immigrants also tend to lean conservative. African and Caribbean communities have their say, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. China is investing trillions of dollars in massive infrastructure projects across the globe. Ports in Cambodia, factories in Malaysia, railroads in Brazil. But the Belt and Road isn't just focused on populated areas. China's ambitions also run deep into the Arctic. In 2018, China launched the Polar Silk Road, a move that's gotten mixed reviews. In today's excerpt from the podcast on China's New Silk Road, reporter Mary Kay Magstad looks at what China wants in the Arctic.
For more than a decade, China has been looking for openings into the Arctic.
It increased exploration and research and declared itself a near-Arctic power, a claim U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo derided at the 2019 Arctic Council meeting in Finland.
Beijing claims to be a near-Arctic state, yet the shortest distance between China and the Arctic is 900 miles. There are only Arctic states and not Arctic states. No third category exists, and claiming otherwise entitles China to exactly nothing.
Or maybe it does, because China's now a permanent observer on the Arctic Council, an intergovernmental forum of Arctic governments, the United States, Russia, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, and Sweden, plus Arctic indigenous communities. And China's made clear its interest in having access to the Northern Sea Route, to the fish and perhaps oil and gas in the Arctic Ocean's high seas, to minerals and rare earths that climate change is making increasingly accessible in Greenland.
So we're approaching Kangerluarsuaq now, going over turquoise-colored lagoon. In the distance, you can see the beginning of the ice sheet.
Welcome to Kangerluarsuaq. Please keep your seatbelt fastened until the fastened seatbelt sign has been switched off.
Greenland's airport of Kangerluarsuaq is about the same distance from New York as Seattle is from Chicago. It's close. That's a big reason why, during World War II, when Nazi Germany took over Denmark and Greenland was still a Danish colony, the United States set up air bases in Greenland to preempt the possibility of Nazi planes being within easy reach of America's east coast. Now there's just one U.S. air base on Greenland, Thule. With growing Russian military activity again in the Arctic, and with growing Chinese interest there, President Trump tried to make up for lost time in August 2019 by offering to buy Greenland, which now has home rule but not full independence, from Denmark.
Essentially, it's a large real estate deal. A lot of things could be done. It's hurting Denmark very badly because they're losing almost $700 million a year carrying it. So they carry it at a great loss. And strategically for the United States, it would be nice.
The $700 million is actually the annual subsidy Denmark gives Greenland. Denmark's Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, called Trump's offer to buy Greenland absurd. Trump called her nasty. At the Arctic Circle conference, Greenland's Prime Minister, Kim Kielsen, said in Greenlandic, "This idea of being bought is alien to our culture, where people can roam and hunt freely and lease land for their homes. So we responded to the offer to buy us by saying, we are not for sale, but we are open for business." Greenland is roughly three times the size of Texas, but it has just 57,000 people, most of them Inuits, who are close cousins of the Inuits in Alaska and Canada. A growing number of Greenlanders are moving to the capital city, Nuuk, population 18,000, for better jobs and better educations.
The smaller communities have difficulty of maintaining people because of the high living costs and the more severe living conditions they have, the poor standards of housing, lack of job opportunities. Lack of training and education is something that forces people to move from small communities to larger communities.
This is Greenland's finance minister, Vitas Kajakutsuk. He's Inuit himself, and like most Greenlanders, he's in favor of Greenland gaining independence from Denmark. But before that can happen, he says, Greenland needs to improve education so the next generation has the capacity to govern. He says his government needs to improve opportunities and quality of life so more Greenlanders stay in Greenland instead of moving abroad. And to make all that happen, he says, investment now, including investment from China, is needed to help the economy grow.
The Greenland government has conducted annual trips to China to promote investment opportunities in Greenland for the past 9 years. And I've been to China in three occasions, in various portfolios I've had, but most recently to promote industrial investment opportunities in Greenland.
China is especially interested in mining rare earths and uranium in Greenland. adding to its already near global monopoly on the rare earths market. The approval process has taken years, says Johannes Cade, a geologist and corporate social responsibility manager with the company Greenland Minerals.
We've been active since 2007 doing exploration, and then we started looking into the feasibility of the mine and also doing the assessments. And we put forward the first draft of these assessments back in 2015.
This would be for rare earths mines in southern Greenland, the one area of Greenland where people can grow crops. Some locals are concerned about the possibility of rare earths tailings, especially from uranium, getting into the water and then into the food supply. Part of Johannes' job is to consult with the public.
So we inform people about uranium, not only us, but also the Department of Minerals.
I would imagine there's a potential risk to the miners, radiation exposure. There's a potential risk to people who live in the area. But then beyond that, there's also strategically kind of a concern about, so then who gets the uranium and what do they do with it?
That's right. And on that part, Denmark plays an important role. So Greenland really doesn't have any foreign policy. It goes through Denmark, everything. So, and Denmark has helped to get through various regulations about radioactive materials, such as ore, how to be handled.
So if there's a Chinese company involved, does that complicate things from the perspective of the Danish government wanting to trace where the uranium's going?
You'd think so, I'm sure.
He says there's actually a strict protocol for tracing uranium, from when it's mined to when and where it's shipped. In this case, Johannes says, a Chinese rare earths company has a stake in an Australian company that will be doing the actual mining, if and when this project goes ahead. Johannes says, personally, he welcomes Chinese investment to Greenland with some reservations.
Even though I welcome the Chinese, because any investment in Greenland, in my opinion, could be good for us. But then again, you've seen how they have affected communities in Africa, where they have financed, for instance, some infrastructure. And then they have a huge influence in those areas. Some people are not so happy with that. We definitely know the Chinese are aggressive in that perspective. But I'm confident that it will not happen in the same way as you see elsewhere in the world.
Down at Nukes Harbor, fishermen lay out their nets with a view of white-capped peaks, a bright blue sky, the occasional whale, and both container ships and free-floating chunks of ice broken off from glaciers. There, too, is the headquarters in royal blue and white of the Joint Arctic Command, Denmark's military presence in Greenland.
Yes, we have several units on the surface, ships. They do military operations. They defend the entire area.
This is Martin Thorpe. He heads operations here.
Surveillance is the biggest task, just figuring out what is going on in the entire area. It goes with the regular frigates, which is more of a new asset. It was decided in 2016 that it was going to be here. And 1 month ago, it came here for the first time.
We're talking in July 2019, so this is the first time that the frigate is patrolling.
That was the maiden voyage of the frigate in our theater and under our command.
And then you have dog sleds.
Yes, that is also part of our operation in the northeastern part of Greenland. We have a dog sled patrol who sort of ensures the sovereignty of Denmark and the national park of northeastern Greenland.
How do the dog sleds do that?
Well, they travel out from a base command, and then they travel out for periods of 2 or 4 months. 2 guys, 13 dogs, and a dog sleigh.
And a Danish flag.
And a Danish flag. That is probably the most important bit.
On the wall of the room where we're speaking is a photo of an Arctic Command officer crouched in the snow, shirtless and bare feet, holding a rifle, 2 dogs behind him, and a polar bear advancing just feet away. Also on the wall is the polar bear's skin. That's one thing to stay vigilant about here in Greenland. Another is Chinese vessels, including research vessels, which Martin Thorpe says are becoming more present in and near Greenland's territorial waters. He says that's not illegal if Chinese researchers have applied for a permit and received no objection. Still, the Arctic Command keeps an eye on who's coming and going. At the University of Greenland, with the evening sky as bright as an afternoon's, I catch up with the chair of Greenland's Research Council, Josephine Nymund. She's a biologist, and on this particular day, she's just back from doing field research on climate change. She says more and more Chinese researchers are coming to Greenland, and there's been Chinese interest in building a ground-based satellite data receiver station in Nuuk.
It was something that we could benefit from because we would get access to high-resolution satellite images almost in real time, which otherwise is really expensive.
She says that could help Greenland researchers like her do their research on climate change.
And the Chinese team that negotiated the project said, yes, absolutely, we will be giving you access to this.
Yeah. That was a kind of the product of the cooperation, was that because they would take down those images anyway, and then they could process it, and they would give it to our group here.
What did they say about why they want to do this?
They have this array of these stations. They have one in Sweden, I know.
And one in Svalbard in Norway, and one in Northern Iceland.
It has to do with getting data, of course, from satellites. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense to have this line of receivers. But I am not the technical person, so I cannot say what exactly they wanted to download. And also, of course, I don't know if they're telling us the truth or not.
In fact, she says, Danish police intelligence officers in Nuuk had questions along those lines. She says they came and did a presentation for researchers here.
You get a little paranoid after having a presentation like that. At least I do. Because then we really cannot do any collaboration because we would be used. Instead of doing a real cooperation, then us as well as maybe the Chinese researchers would be misused by the Chinese government. And that is really difficult to see through.
But what does that mean for ordinary people here? I check in with a local journalist.
Hi, I'm Inge S. Rasmussen. I work as a journalist here at the newspaper. It's called Aduagatliutit Grønlandsposten, in short, AG.
Inge grew up in Denmark and moved to Greenland 20 years ago. She's been working as a journalist here ever since and is married to a Greenlander. She says in recent years here in Greenland, there's been a pretty wide and growing range of Chinese investments and interest in investments here in fish and seafood processing, where more than 100 Chinese migrant workers have been brought in to increase efficiency, in mining, and in refurbishing airports. Inga says as a journalist here, she hears a fair bit of ambivalence about prospects for Chinese investment. Inga says Greenlanders in general still don't know a lot about what Chinese investors want and how it might affect Greenland.
We can read about, okay, so what have they done in Africa or other parts in the world? Maybe they won't do it there. Or maybe they will. Should we be afraid? We don't know. I mean, what this country needs is are people willing to invest.
But people willing to invest in a way that's in Greenland's best interests.
Preferably. But still, we are still dependent on Denmark, which is in turn dependent on U.S. Mm. So we are also very much dependent on the United States. And being situated where we are, I find it very hard to believe that whoever is in charge in the U.S. will allow for anything to be compromised in this chunk of ice that is Greenland.
The biggest number of Chinese coming to Greenland these days are tourists who hop over from Iceland. And a construction boom in Nuuk includes building hotels in the hope that the new expanded airport will bring in more tourists after COVID-19 ends. But not too many more tourists. Iceland has been getting 5 times more visitors per year than there are people in Iceland. Greenland, with its 57,000 people, gets roughly that same number of tourists per year. Vitas Kajokatsok, Greenland's finance minister, says Greenland needs to go at a slower pace.
Our capacity is too small, looking at the hotels and the service functions. We have restaurants, etc. they need to be built up before we can obtain more tourists. So it requires a considerable effort, not only money investments, but we would need labor from abroad to cover the needs that the tourists might have.
Right now, Greenland's government gets about half its public budget in a grant from Denmark, and Greenland's economy relies on fisheries for almost half its locally generated GDP. Vita says Greenland needs to diversify. Nuuk is growing and will continue to grow. Some estimates are that its population will grow 50% in the next decade. That would mean that Greenlanders, who'd long roamed and hunted and fished in remote areas, would need good jobs and education for their kids and help with adjusting to a new way of life, since climate change is cutting into the old one. And if Chinese companies come along offering investments that will help Greenland's government provide a better life for all those people?
Well, I'm just saying that at the end of the day, it's not interesting for me whether the money comes from China or from US or from Canada or from any other country. For me, the most interesting part is making progress and growth in Greenland. But on the other hand, we have other considerations in terms of security matters, which foreign bodies that we attract to Greenland, not only short term, but in the long term, what good it does for our position.
Better, he says, would be a closer relationship with Greenland's closest neighbors, the United States and Canada. A new U.S. consulate has just opened in Nuuk for the first time since 1953. The wake-up call has been received. Climate change is opening the Arctic to new players and new challenges to U.S. interests. And without more active U.S. engagement here, melting ice may not be the only change that comes to the Arctic.
Mary Kay Magsad reporting for the Global Reporting Center. Listen to this and other stories about China's global vision on the podcast On China's New Silk Road. With just 3 weeks left until Election Day, candidates are looking for every last vote, leaving no stone unturned. Immigrants could play a key role in some close races. We've heard a lot about the large and growing number of Latino voters in the U.S. Another one of the fastest growing immigrant voting groups, black voters from Africa and the Caribbean. The World's Halima Gikandi has more now about this diverse group of voters.
Peter O'Para remembers when he first heard about President Donald Trump. The 66-year-old was born in Nigeria and moved to New York City in the 70s. Trump was just starting to make a name for himself, and O'Para liked his style.
He's not a politician, and he speaks his mind, does things the way he believes should be done.
O'Para identified with his strong, can-do business attitude. That's what he likes about the Republican Party in general. It reminds him of his tribe in Nigeria, the Igbo.
Igbo as a people. It's all about industry. It's all about family. It's all about doing what you're supposed to do, you know.
O'Para voted for Trump in 2016, which was a surprising and unpopular choice with his family and friends. Most are Democrats. It's less surprising to Kevin Thomas. He's a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas in Austin.
Black immigrants are obviously much more diverse than people actually think, than Joe Biden definitely thinks, right? You have the regional differences, right? People coming from Africa, the Caribbean, South America.
That diversity extends to political and social issues as well.
What the data actually showing is that, at least in terms of political ideology, black immigrants tend to lean more on the conservative side than the liberal side.
Black immigrants are also one of the fastest growing immigrant groups, especially those coming from African countries. Thomas says they are changing the makeup of the black electorate.
Some studies suggest that currently about one in four black people in the United States is either a black immigrant or the child of a black immigrant.
But unlike other immigrant groups, they haven't always been visible during elections. They are still a relatively small immigrant group, and Thomas finds they don't vote as often. But that could be changing, says Eric Eddy, who was born in the Ivory Coast. He leads the Coalition of African and Caribbean Communities in Philadelphia. He says Trump's past comments about African countries and immigrant restrictions could encourage people to vote.
The attack that, you know, we have seen recently from the Trump administration on immigration laws or on immigrants, etc., we have tried to use that as avenues, ways, or enhance immigrants' awareness that, hey, if you are able to vote and you vote, you can actually change this kind of policies.
But immigration isn't the only issue that Black immigrants care about. Thomas from the University of Texas says it might drive some voters to Democrats, but not when it comes to issues like abortion and gay marriage.
Black immigrants, especially first-generation Black immigrants, have to juggle, you know, their own interests, the personal interest, right, with some of the stuff that, you know, their political ideologies, their conservative beliefs.
Philomena Desmond Ogugua knows who she's voting for. Ogugua was born in Nigeria and co-founded a group called African Diaspora for Biden. They've been mobilizing African communities across the U.S.
The battleground states, which are going to be the decisive factor in this election, are the states where we have many of our brothers and sisters residing.
Notably, states like Florida, which has the second largest population of Black immigrants, and Minnesota, where Somali immigrants have been shaping the political landscape there. Ogugua says Biden should be the choice for African immigrant voters because he has a long track record on the continent.
If one should go back to the Senate and look at Biden's comments on the floor of the Senate and his voting patterns, when it comes to Africa, he has always been strong, is a strong voice on African issues, even during apartheid.
She points to a video from 1986 that's been circulating online recently. It shows a young Senator Biden criticizing the Reagan administration for its policies towards apartheid South Africa.
Damn it, we have favorites in South Africa. The favorites in South Africa are the people who are being repressed by that ugly white regime. We have favorites. Our loyalty is not to South Africa, it's to South Africans. And the South Africans are majority Black, and they are being excoriated.
Peter Opera, the Nigerian-American Republican voter who grew up in New York, remembers that moment too.
So I said, oh my God, look at this guy. He identifies with what we are fighting against. So I wrote him a letter thanking him.
It's one reason why Opera is considering voting for Biden. Even though he does approve of President Trump's handling of the pandemic and his tough stance on the WHO, he's been put off by Trump's wavering over COVID relief packages.
Mr. Trump, why don't you let this negotiation of economic relief go on with the Republicans? Why did you call it off? Call it back on. Let them come up with something. Because people are suffering, man. People are suffering.
Opera says the decision about COVID aid will determine who gets his vote. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Fall temperatures are dropping, and more we're staying inside, hence a lot more discussion of mail-in and absentee ballots than usual. Autumn also means we're entering a new phase of the coronavirus with a growing sense of pandemic fatigue. That's what we're talking about tomorrow in our series of online conversations about COVID-19 in partnership with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Join us online tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern at theworld.org. History made at the Roland Garros Tennis Center in Paris yesterday, again. Rafael Nadal with the winning ace there to take home his record-smashing 13th French Open tennis title. Nobody else comes anywhere close to that lucky number 13. Nadal took the world's number one ranked player, Novak Djokovic, to school in straight sets. That's not me saying that. Djokovic said his opponent played the first two sets perfect. Nadal did not disagree.
Yeah, well, of course I played at an amazing level of tennis now. The first two sets and a half I played great, honestly.
Sunday's win was also Nadal's 20th career Grand Slam title. That includes wins at the Australian Open, U.S. Open, and Wimbledon. 20 Grand Slam titles ties Nadal with Roger Federer for most of all time. Nadal said it means a lot to share the mantle with his longtime friendly rival.
But let's see what's going on when we finish our careers. No, we keep playing.
In the quest to be the greatest of all time, advantage Nadal. At age 34, he is 5 years younger than Federer. I'm not keeping score, just leaving it here at love. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow. From PR.